This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
We're sending a very good evening to West Trenton, New Jersey. Hello, this is Cravings here on Joy 94.9. We're going to keep you entertained today with some international superstars. There are three of them. Restaurant number four in the world is called Central. You're going to meet a fellow by the name of Virgilio Martinez. Tad, we're also going to meet Kalum Chan, who's an encyclopedic knowledge of Chinese food.
It's very exciting. It's going to be a great show.
33 regions of Chinese cuisine. And also the fabulous Ashley Palmer-Watts from Dinner by Heston Blumenthal. All of that is coming up. Stay with Tad and I. We're here until 2 o'clock.
Our buzzword today is cravings. Cravings. We're talking cravings.
Well, good afternoon. Yes, we are 6.5 minutes, almost 7 minutes past one. Thank you, Tim Lennox, for the news this morning. We've got a lot to get through.
There is. A big show today.
Very big show. It's always a big show.
It always is, yeah.
But we have three outstanding international superstars to introduce you to today. And sadly, because I've caught them all in the last couple of days, it's going to be a lot of my voice and very little of yours, Tad. Which,
that's
for
right.
Those people listening in is it New Trenton?
West Trenton.
West Trenton in New Jersey, of which there, I believe, is a huge collective this evening.
That's right.
I need to say happy Thanksgiving to all of them. Because
that's right.
Is it the end of Thanksgiving? That
it is.
Is that why they're together?
That's right. So Thanksgiving was on Thursday in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then the day after is a public holiday known as Black Friday, which is a big shopping day.
I know. Yeah. I've had so many tweets and emails about 30% off.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, so it's like Boxing Day, but just a bit early.
And
there's plenty of stock to go around, not just a little bit here and there. Yeah.
So they're all together. They're probably still feasting on leftover pumpkin pie and making something with leftover turkey.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, pumpkin pie is starting to be a thing in Australia.
Yeah, but we can't buy the pumpkin in cans like you can in the US.
No. But you do it properly. You know, you roast it, and it's much nicer. So.
I agree. We were talking about it in our office the other day.
Yep.
Did you do something for Thanksgiving?
No, I've made pumpkin pies, obviously, but we'll probably do something on Sunday. It's not a day off here, so you know, you have to.
I think we need to start lobbying the government for a day off.
Unless you live on Norfolk Island, right?
Yeah, that was a really good show last week.
We're
putting all of that together.
Thank you. Today,
there are eight sort of superhero regions of China for cuisine.
Yep. It's actually quite amazing food in China.
There are something like 38 different secular regions of China for cuisine. So a fellow by the name of Kalum Chan and his wife Doria Chan have just produced a book by Fiden, called China. And it's pretty much an encyclopedic wander through all of those regions of China and recipes and things that talk about specific regionality within the cuisine. So it was a really interesting chat I had with him. He's a fascinating man.
It would have been. Have you had a chance to go to China at all? Or
No, it's so on my list.
Yeah, I have, fortunately, and not all, you know, 38 regions, but
I've been to Hong Kong.
That counts.
Yeah. Well, when I went to Hong Kong, it wasn't with China.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of independent. And,
right.
So, yeah, I'm quite looking forward to...
the food's amazing.
The food is outstanding.
It is.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're also going to speak to Ashley Palmer-Watts. He is the exec chef at Dinner by Heston Blumenthal. He's been with Heston for 17 years.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? How long it's been.
And this week they're announced as the number one restaurant in Victoria's list of top 100 restaurants in Vic.
Yep.
And I caught it with Ashley to have a bit of a chat and eat some of his very special dessert he's created for the first birthday.
Yes.
And also, Virgilio Martinez from Central in Lima in Peru. His restaurant is number 4 in the world.
Yep.
He's been in town this week.
He has.
He's a delightful young man, and we chatted earlier as well. So why don't we start with a few messages, and we'll bring you that very first chat with a fellow by the name of Kailum Chan, who is just... He and his wife have the most ridiculous knowledge of Chinese cuisine going around. So we'll have a couple of brief messages, and we'll bring that to you straight away.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Kailum Chan and his partner in life and in crime, Durafong Chan, have created, I think, one of the most stunning encyclopedic books on Chinese cuisine that I've ever seen. It's produced by Faden, and I'm delighted that Kailum is in the studio with me. Welcome.
Hello, Peter.
Tell me a little bit about how you have built up a knowledge over 40 years of the extensive world that is Chinese cuisine.
Well, I started at home, actually, quite early in life. My father was a very known, well-known gourmet, as well as a writer in cookbooks. So between 1951 and 53, he published 10 books called Food Classics that are still being published and sold today, more than 60 years later. So I started early at home. I learned from him a lot as a kid. And then until I went to school away from home. And then I started to cook for myself. So that sort of got my interest started. But then my real knowledge on Chinese food really did not start until I started to work in Beijing. I spent 5 years living in Beijing, and then afterwards for many years, my wife and I traveled pretty much on all of the provinces in Beijing, in China, with the exception of Tibet, because of high altitude. So we were able to collect a lot of information on food, on people, on recipes, on ingredients, and so we built up a pretty good library at home, and that we can draw from. And with that, we started to write cookbooks after we retired from. No, I have my own. I was in the IT industry, and she has a business in steel structure engineering. So after we retired, we didn't really have much to do. So the publisher came to us and said, why don't you write a cookbook? So that got us started, and we wrote our first cookbook in 2010. And since then, we published 16 cookbooks before we published the current one.
And what inspired this particular book? Because, as I mentioned, it is absolutely encyclopedic, and I think there's not a part of China that wouldn't be covered in this, because the diversity of Chinese cuisine is quite extraordinary.
Yes, it certainly is. When Faden came to us and saying, please do a cookbook on China, we really thought about it and hesitated because such widespread and the diversity, as you mentioned, is so great. But we finally decided to do the book because there's no such book in the world. Okay, we think, well, it would be good to do a book that covers entire China. Initially, they only wanted a book that covers the 8 great regional styles, plus maybe a few others. And we thought that if the book is to carry China on its cover, then it's got to be for the entire country, not part of it. So we went and included around 33 regions and sub-regions that covers pretty much the entire country. Of course, there are still some areas that are uncovered because there are just too many. But I would say we do a pretty good representation of all of the cuisines.
For those people who are at home fascinated by this story, as I am, what are the 8 great regions that you talk about, the 8 great cuisines of China?
Okay, they're quite well known. Cantonese, Sichuanese, Hunanese, and Fujian, and then the Zhejiang, Jiangsu, Anhui, and Shandong. Those are the 8 provinces that is on the southern and southeastern side. And that has been, well, I guess we're blessed with a little warfare over the years and plenty of ingredients. So that's why they developed the eight cuisines.
And then if you were to think of the cuisine of places like Taipei and Taiwan, I think is Hakka cuisine?
Hakka and Fukien.
Okay, so that's one of the eight.
Taiwan is not part of it, but they were influenced by it.
So how do you sit down and we've sort of talked about the diversity, the size of China. It's an extraordinarily big country. And yes, and if you take those 33 different regions, is there a way that you can sort of mentally start the process and say, well, these are the 33 regions we have to go to? Or did you start with the eight and think, oh, but we need to add that, oh, we need to add that?
No, we started with the idea of doing the entire country. So with the eight were quite well known.
Yeah.
And we spent more time looking at all of the others that were less well known and start to go into it more and see what was it that we already have, what was it that we don't have and need to go after. So we were lucky to have in our own library about 1,200 recipes already. So we were asked to deliver 800. So from the 1,200, we started to select 800. And that was not an easy process. The first 600 was fine. Yeah. The last 200 was very painful. It was so bad that I almost said, let's give up.
Yeah.
Because we tried to maintain a good balance, making sure every province, every area is properly represented, and also a balance between ingredients. Now, I cannot have too much seafood or too much pork and lamb and so. So it's got a good balance all across. And the last 200 recipes were very difficult because of that.
If we think from an Australian perspective, we understand there's been a very westernized version of Chinese food that has been developed here over the last sort of 60 or 70 years. And if we think of Chinese, we would go straight to things like sweet and sour pork or fried rice, black bean sauce on some beef. I wonder if you can give me a bit of an idea of what the food of the western provinces of China is like compared to the southeast and how different it is.
Well, the western part of China throughout history was very much under the influence of, I would say, West Asia, since the Silk Road started about 1,500 years ago. Okay, so a lot of new ingredients, new methods were sort of brought over from the West, as well as people living from the West areas, West Asia areas, moving into China. Okay, that made a difference. Also, the religion makes a difference. Islam came into China again through the Silk Road. And so if you look at Western China, you see more and more food that are lamb-based, that make much use of herbs, spices, and also the practice of the way they make bread, and also the Islam way of making halal.
So the way animals are killed.
That's right. So I would say if you go to the western part of China, you will see a lot more foreign influence from West Asia. Okay, as compared to East China, for example, where the food is very refined. Because culturally, historically, a lot of poets and writers and emperors would go to East China because of the availability of the ingredients and the good food. And as such, the culture brought with it refinement. And so if we talk about refined Chinese cuisine, you should go to East China.
Kalim Chan is my guest with his wife, Diora. They have produced a beautiful book that has charted China's cultural diversity through its cuisine, and I'm delighted he's here to talk to us about it. What part of China did you grow up in to start your journey?
In southern China, in Guangdong. Mm-hmm. I lived in Hong Kong for many years. Mm-hmm. So that's where I guess I grew up. That's where I learned most of my basic knowledge about cooking, about food. And it was only until I grew up and lived in China that I really get into all the various kinds of food.
And then I guess the next part of the journey is how the food of China has influenced other parts of Asia. So the influences of Chinese cuisine in places like Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, parts of Thailand. Has it been a big influence, the way that China has, not dominated, I don't think that's the word, but the way that China has influenced the rest of Southeast Asia?
Well, I think the influence go both ways. Mm. Of course, to go back in history, first of all, chopsticks were invented in China and I think exported to Korea and Japan. The way we eat, we in the old days, before we have tables and chairs, we sat on the floor. Mm-hmm. And they still do that in Japan and Korea. So that's part of the culinary culture that we exported in the early days. Of course, the influence goes both ways. Okay. On the one hand, on the export side, mm-hmm. we have a lot of people leaving China, moving to other areas. Mm-hmm. For example, the Hakka people and the Fujian people, as well as Cantonese, move into Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. and brought with them their food. And if you go to Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand today, you will see a lot of food from Hakka. Mm. But vice versa, we were influenced by food from that area as well. For example, the shark fin actually comes from Southeast Asia into China. Mm-hmm. So even though we like shark fin soup, we know that the origin really came from Southeast Asia. Things like swallow's nest, again, an import from that area. Satay, which we like a lot. Yes, yes. The southeastern Malaysian food is very, very much a favorite in China, especially in southern China. So the influence goes both ways. Mm. And throughout the ages, Chinese cuisine is very, very good in terms of assimilating inputs from overseas and made it into part of our own. And we see this trend continuing. For example, in modern Chinese cuisine, in restaurants certainly, they are making use of a lot of Western ingredients. Mm. Now, some of the more exotic, more expensive ingredients like truffles and so on, and they will add it to their dishes. Now, whether it's good or not, that depends, but this is what they do today. Mm. And I think that is good that they are able to create and to think of new things, and hopefully some of these will stay.
Mm. It's fascinating that you went to the Western influence on China, because that was sort of my next question. How much has the growth of the internet and technology allowed Chinese cuisine to evolve with influences from the French and from Australia and from various parts of Europe and North America?
Well, there are a lot of it, in fact. I would say over the last 30 years, since the reform and opening up of China, people were really hunger for things from the outside. Mm. Almost everything that was brought into China were almost instantly accepted. Now, McDonald's went in many years ago, and boom, all of a sudden it became very popular. As well as Western cuisine, people, especially younger people, they want something from the West. This is new to them, and they liked it because they find food to be very different and very tasty. Of course, they still like the traditional foods at home, and that I think that would never go away. Mm. But the experience of having something new, something exotic, is what really gets people interested. So nowadays, we see food from all over the world, in fact, Australian or Japanese or Korean, certainly American and so on. You can find them all over China, and they are really... more and more restaurants like this are opening up, and the Chinese themselves are starting to change. Mm-hmm. Okay, they adapt Western methods in their cooking sometimes, mm-hmm. and try to blend in, try to make something new. Mm-hmm. I think especially the younger people want something that is exciting. Mm-hmm. Well, food is good at home, but it's not as exciting mm-hmm. as something new.
Yeah,
so I think they want both, the mm-hmm. good stuff at home and the exciting stuff they get from outside.
Caleb Chan is my guest. Caleb, I'm curious, is there any risk of some of these very old traditional Chinese methods and ingredients. Is there any risk of that starting to fade as the dominance of the West does take over in any younger generation? Or is there enough of China and enough of those traditions that it will never disappear?
I think part of them are sort of leaving us. Well, of course, we have so many years of history, then a great part will, of course, stay. And in fact, this is one of the reasons why we decided to write the book. Because whether some of these dishes will be popular in homes, we would like to write it down just as a record so that people, at least, you know, it's somewhere people can find it. It won't become a lost recipe of China. But yes, some of them will eventually be lost, unfortunately. But maybe this is part of history. You know, some will stay, some will go, and new ones will replace them. My concern is that many of the new innovations may not last the test of time. And eventually they will go away and then nothing will remain.
Do you have... what's the favourite thing that you and Dira like to eat in your home when you cook together at the end of a day? Is there something you like to cook that is... because of its simplicity or because it's rustic or because it's your favourite thing to eat when you're just simply at home?
Well, I would say fish.
Fish?
First of all, fish is easy to cook. We have good fish in Hong Kong. You can get almost any kind. And the only kind we like are those that are swimming in a tank. And we will usually just steam it because this way you get the best part of the fish. And the other thing we like is to make something like soy sauce chicken. This is an easy to do dish, and everybody I know likes it. So those are simple things we like. The other thing we like to do is to make a lot of dumplings or wontons because we freeze them.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't feel like cooking much. We take our 20 wontons and cook them, and everybody gets 10.
Yeah.
So this is sort of what we do at home. We don't usually cook big meals. There are only two of us, so we cook very little. Unless friends come to visit, then we do a 5-6-course meal.
Okay, Lim Chan, it has been a delight to meet you. Thank you for spending some time with me and talking about this book. It is simply called China, the Cookbook. It is available through Fiden, and I'm sure any good bookstore that you walk into will carry it. It's a great big heavy tome. It's beautiful. Thank you, Kailum.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Hi, I'm Heston Blumenthal. You're with Pete Dillon on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
Ah, this is... We are speeding through this show, Tad.
We are. We're really going well.
Fascinating man, yep. Kailum Chan. And the knowledge of Chinese cuisine is outstanding.
Like, it's like an encyclopedia of Chinese food. Pretty incredible.
Now we have to move to a British chef in Australia. We mentioned at the top of the program, Ashley Palmer-Watts is the executive chef of Dinner by Heston Blumenthal. He opened Dinner in London.
Yes.
He opened Dinner here a year ago, celebrating their first birthday. So I caught up with him and thought we'd have a bit of a chat about that first birthday and all sorts of things. So now here is that chat. This is a very weird program we're doing today. You're here on Cravings on Joy 94.9. It's 18 minutes to 2. We've met Ashley Palmer-Watts before. He is the executive chef at Dinner by Heston Blumenthal at Crown. I can't believe, Ashley, it's already been a year that you've been open, and here we are again talking about success that's just rolling on and on and on.
Yeah, it's flown by. But, we're certainly really pleased to, you know, have just picked up the award in Victoria and, just pleased to be part of it, you know.
You've just preempted my very first question. Number one on Victoria's list of hottest or best 100 restaurants. That's is that a surprise to you?
Complete surprise. I mean, everything that, you know, awards like that just make people happy and kind of spur them on, you know.
Are you just trying to be humble?
Always humble, you know, always humble. No, we just concentrate on what we do at the table, service, good food, that whole interactive side. And, you know, the awards and recognition come on the back of that, really.
It's nice to know, though, that that Victoria's embraced you and taken those ideas from something that is particularly British and said, you know, hey, this is cool, this is great, we can get into this. So what do you think that's been? Is it the fact that we've got... such good produce for you to use? Or is it the fact that it's got Heston's name to it? Or is it the fact that we just love to eat here?
I think it's a combination of all those things. And I think above all else, when you come to the restaurant, our main goal is for everyone to have such a great time, have great food, relax, have great service, learn something new, explore new things. And it's predominantly British, but, like, for example, what's in front of you is predominantly Australian, and especially Melbourne. So it's about embracing local culture, local sort of history, and having a bit of fun with it.
Well, let's talk about what's in front of me here, because you've created two desserts, I think, to celebrate the first birthday of Dinner by Heston Blumenthal at Crown. The first of which you couldn't bring here into the studio because it's just a bit messy, and it's a bit MasterChef-y, and it looks like it needs some tricks and whistles. Yeah. That's the egg. Now, the egg, I think, is already on the menu.
Yeah, the egg is going on this week, and it's the one that we did for MasterChef Final this year. It's incredibly difficult to do. It's taken us a further 3 months to work it into a point where we can actually produce enough to put on the menu. So it's based on an emu egg, sort of beautifully mottled blue eggshell with white inside.
Sure. So it sounds like has it got a bit of acidity, obviously, to it, this egg, so that the verjuice gives it that point of difference, and the yuzu jelly?
Yeah, I think it's about sort of breaking into something. It's about discovery. It's about coconut. We make it with coconut water, so it's a very, very light set panna cotta. You've got the coffee. The flavour combination itself is really interesting. It doesn't sound like it should work, but when you actually eat down through the layers, it completely works, and hopefully it should blow people away.
So are you surprised by the way we've taken to these sort of very, very old stories? Obviously, our history is 40,000 plus years old, but our settlement history, the way we eat now, is only a couple of hundred years old, adopted from predominantly the Brits and the Irish. Are you surprised at how enchanted we are by these stories that are much older and much more significant in British history?
Yeah, I mean, the interest is brilliant, and that's, you know, that for us is really exciting. But we're looking at the Australian side of history and what makes kind of Australia tick from the settlement point of view. And working with a historian in Adelaide called Barbara Santich, she said, look, you must do something with the cherry ripe. And then when we thought about that, there's a real balance of history, but it's a real sort of recent history and almost a higher balance of nostalgia and what makes people smile. So it's kind of a lot more nostalgia here than just in Great Britain. Mm.
So let's talk about this cherry ripe, because it's sitting in front of me looking delicious. So this is your take on the cherry ripe bar that we are all so familiar with.
Yes. So when looking into the cherry ripe bar, it was invented in Melbourne in 1924, and the Mac Robinson family invented it here in Melbourne. We look back at the name, and the name appears as if it came from a piece of poetry written by a guy called Robert Herrick in the UK. In 1591, he was born. And he wrote a piece of poetry that made reference to cherry ripe, and about the Cherry Isle. And about 80 years later, another chap, a composer, wrote a piece of music to turn this poetry into a song. So for us, this is just brilliant. Mm. Like, it's so rich with its history and linkage. It's brilliant.
And what's it consist of? Because it looks very simple, but I'm assuming it's not.
Yeah, so on the bottom, we've got a kind of crumbly chocolate biscuit base, and then above that we've got a little gooey coconut sponge, like very, very soft coconut, and then we've got a Morello cherry jam, and then surrounded with a chocolate mousse, and then we spray it with chocolate so it kind of looks like flocked and powdery. And if you just eat down through the layers, I mean, it goes with other things. This is just the bar part, but I think we've used it for our interpretation of something that's very dear to lots of Australians and makes them smile.
And celebrating a year on, I can't believe it's been a year. I say that again. What's been the biggest challenge you've faced? Because I know when we first sat down and spoke, we talked a lot about how you've recruited your team, where they've come from. What's been the big change over the last 12 months for you?
Well, I think as people have come to the restaurant and kind of understood what dinner is. You know, we came here and we opened 6 months after the Fat Duck left and went back to the UK. So I think there might have been an expectation of what the restaurant was without actually knowing. So it's a large restaurant. It's predominantly a la carte. You know, we do a tasting degustation on the chef's table, but it's a la carte. You can come in for steak and chips and meat, fruit and tipsy cake, or you can come in for much more intricate, involved, finer dishes than steak and chips. But
and I know we also spoke then about the pressure on you in a venue that doesn't carry your name. Has that pressure subsided? Is the bald bloke happy enough?
Heston, yeah, he's over the moon. I mean, you know, I've worked with Heston for over 17 years. Yeah. In terms, I don't get up in the morning and think, oh, we've got Heston's name on the door, and oh, we've got all this pressure and expectation. We just try and concentrate on what we're doing, and you know, we have a large team here in Melbourne, nearly 100 people. It's about inspiring them, running them, and making them sort of be part of that whole process, the whole movement. Mm.
I'm sort of thinking back as well. I remember trying to get into the Melbourne version of the Fat Duck was impossible. And I know when dinner first opened, it was kind of hard to get into. Can I get a booking?
Yeah, I mean, the fair thing to say is it's a really large restaurant. Mm. We do take walk-ins every day. You know, you've got to be prepared to have a little drink in the bar, wait 15, 20 minutes, but we're always trying to squeeze people in. Weekends are tricky, need to book in advance, but definitely Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday for dinner, we definitely got space, and we open Friday, Saturday, Sunday for lunch too. So,
and it's not just a special occasion. I mean, it's a beautiful exploration of culinary tradition and all of those sort of intricate things that food has become known for. There's a touch of magic in there that exists as well. You mentioned the meat fruit before. It's a most beautifully presented dish and a lovely sort of challenge to the mind, because we tend to eat with our eyes first. So it doesn't have to be that break the bank situation either, does it?
No, not at all. And you know, for December we're running a different meat fruit, and it's a spiced plum, red wine plum meat fruit. And but you can just come in and have a couple of drinks at the bar. It's you know, from 9:30 every night we're open. Yeah. You can come in, sit, lovely vista over the dining room, look over the city, historically inspired cocktails, olive leaf martini, cider gimlet, ribberu pink gin. It's yeah, you can come in at different levels. So, you know, pop in, have a drink, see what it's like. And, you know, if you feel like staying for dinner, we'll try and fit you in.
And I imagine there's a perception because of the name that's associated with it. I don't want to keep mentioning his name because it's not about him at all. because there is that perception, I guess people think, oh, that's got to be really expensive because it's Heston.
No, it's not any more expensive than any reasonable quality good restaurant in Melbourne. We like to sit in amongst, you know, it's at the upper end, but it's not out of reach of main dining. No,
it's not a vue du monde, is it? let's move on. Congratulations on the first year. I still can't believe it's been a year, and continued success. How long are you back in Melbourne for before you take off again?
I'm actually flying back today, but I've been here about 2.5 weeks, mm-hmm. And I'll be back in January for the Australia Day. So be part of the celebrations, and, you know, we've got a few surprises.
You're missing our New Year's Eve fireworks, which is a great disgrace.
I know, I was here last year. I'm totally gutted I'm not here, but I need to spend New Year with my family back in the UK, so next year.
Yeah. Mate, it's good to see you again. Thank you for coming in, and we'll catch up in January when you're here.
Will do. Thanks very much.
I was at work.
I was riding my horse.
I was microwaving a watermelon.
My iguanas escaped.
There are lots of reasons why you may have missed your favourite show, but don't worry, because our podcast team has you covered. They'll work through rain, hail and national glitter shortages to bring you the best bits of every show. Visit joy.org.au and click on the podcast tab, or head to the iTunes Australia podcast store and subscribe to your favourite shows for free. Thanks to our podcasters, you'll never feel guilty about missing a show again. Joy.org.au.
Here here on Joy 94.9. Tad, we've got to be very, very quick.
We do.
We're going to very quickly say goodbye because we're going to our next interview, and then after that interview we'll play some sponsorship announcements, and then we'll hand you straight over to the Escape Pod. Russ is back from the USA and South America. He's been and met the mother-in-law, so we're sure to hear all about that on the Escape Pod after 2 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you for joining me. You'll be on your own next week, flying solo.
Woo! Yes, I know. Look out. Good. Yep.
So Tad will be here by himself. Do you know what you're doing? Do you know who you've got on?
I haven't confirmed it yet, so I won't actually say, but I have my ideas, so yeah.
And we have to very quickly say to the person that sent the with Christmas coming, can you please give us some vegan lunch tips? Ian Tass, we cannot. So we're going to bring you a discussion with Virgilio Martinez. His restaurant is number 4 in the world in Lima, in Peru. Fascinating young man, absolutely adorable. I won't be here next week. I'll see you when I see you.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks. Here is Virgilio, and thank you for joining us today. You're on Joy 94.9.
Virgilio Martinez is a chef like no other. He's from Peru, a former semi-professional skateboarder-turned-chef whose influence is directed to shamans and high priests who, in some senses, influence what he does. Welcome to Cravings.
Hello, how are you? Happy to be with you, talking.
Tell me about how you went from being a semi-professional skateboarder to a kitchen.
Well, it's not that... There's not much difference about doing skateboarding and cooking. You know, like you work.
I'm a chef and I can't skateboard.
You work long hours.
Yes.
Yes. You work with a team, mm-hmm. of course. Yeah, you have teams.
Yep.
You have to be very hyperactive, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Creative.
Right.
Yeah.
A little bit crazy.
Yeah. A lot of that. Yeah.
How did looking at your book, Central, based on your restaurant in Peru, and your elevation, like you focus on the elevation of the topography of Peru, the elevation of your career to number 4 in the world. Are you a little bit surprised at how much attention people have paid to what you do?
I think now it's kind of, I have to pay attention of the expectation of the people about maybe Peru, mm-hmm. which is like a country full of history and tradition and ingredients and biodiversity. So if the restaurant is achieving to give you one experience and just translate all these things that are happening in Peru, I think the restaurant is gonna do good, and all this, the way that Central is improving and getting some attention is because of all these things happening in Peru, and it's just a consequence.
The focus on your restaurant is all about Peru. Everything is Peruvian. I'm assuming if you can't find what you need, then you don't use it.
No, the ideas and the philosophy and the whole thing is like very global. I mean, like if you see Peru, one of the most biodiverse places in the world, and you see the world in Peru. So there are many things that you can find even here, being so far away that probably I wouldn't say that belong to Peru, but we share.
The background of Peruvian is. Is predominantly based in ancient Spanish behavior, but there's a huge Japanese population in Peru. There's great cultural diversity. Do you draw your influence from the diversity of culture, or do you draw your influence from what nature gives you?
It's more driven to by nature and driven by even the pre-Incas time, probably all this ancient culture and knowledge and I think what happened after the Spanish came to Peru, it was just great. It was just still, it's a fusion, a melting pot. But this is not what Central is doing nowadays. We are like more focused on what's happening in nature, in the Amazon, in the Andes, and even in the Pacific coast.
And how are you influenced by shamans and high priests in villages that you go to? How much do they alter the way you think about an ingredient or an idea or a philosophy even around your food?
Oh, they are actually the real knowledge that we need, and those are our best suppliers on ideas, on styles, on not only ingredients. So we really have to show some respect to all these native communities that live in very far away from our cities. And I think, yeah, they are part of Central. So that's why our main goal is to communicate what's or promote what's happening over there.
Is food for you a philosophical or a spiritual thing rather than something that's practical, rather than just feeding people? There's a spiritual side to what you do?
Oh, yeah, of course. Both things, like what you said, spiritual and it's something that, of course, there's a philosophy behind the whole thing. But yeah, there's a lot of emotions in one experience. Even in the kitchen, everybody's so emotional, and you know, the emotion in the kitchen, you probably know, is different than the emotion in the dining room. Yes. You know, in the dining room, the rhythms are different. So you have to try to be everywhere.
In the dining room, they waltz. In the kitchen, they rumba.
Yeah.
Mm. The diversity of ingredients. I was thinking earlier about the similarity between yourself and to some degree Alex Atala, who I know from Dom in Sao Paulo, works with Amazonian tribes and sort of grows into the community and becomes a part of the community and supports the community to not just go in and take, that there's a bit of give back. And I understand your philosophy is very much like that.
Yeah, I mean, we just can't build a relationship with if you don't give something, and I'm not saying about, you know, just paying a check or giving something like that. It's just giving your time and you know promotion, conversations and stuff like that. So yeah, I think we have to work. Nowadays, they are our best suppliers, and I was telling you, like, best suppliers on ideas, and actually, they actually motivate our work every single day. So we still have to visit these communities probably every week, and we need a team to do that. Now we work with anthropologists and botanists and biologists and artists and people that really are keen to and keen and very sensible to understand what happened in these communities.
Virgilio Martinez is from Central in Peru. His restaurant is number 4 on the San Pellegrino Top 50. The Top 50 is about to come out again, and it times well with the release of your book, Central. Talk to me about the book and how you determined what the book would look like, not just from a visual point of view, but that is able to chart your journey, I suppose.
It's a book about an exploration of Peru, which has a strong message of preservation of natural ecosystems in the world. So it's how, well, Peru could be an example of, because of where we live in this biodiverse geography, we can show that we can do something with food and how food is connecting us. And we, you know, we just made a book based on different altitudes, and which is very, I wouldn't say complex, but it's
certainly challenging.
It needs sometimes to have a good read and think about, you know, very important things.
So it's a thinking man's book. It's not a cook's book.
Well, both, you know?
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
Tell me about your childhood. Growing up, how did you see the world when you were little?
Well, I used to live by the sea, so I had lots of connection with fishermen. But yeah, I lived in Peru where Peru was difficult. You know, the Shining Path, terrorism, and economy wasn't good. So it was like, we had all these ideas of just leaving Peru or, you know, moving to another country, which is not happening now. I mean, like, now we are Peruvians. We are so happy to be Peruvians and so happy to you know, to visit different parts of Peru where probably before we were not able to go because it was dangerous. Mm.
So you now travel the world. You cook with chefs all over the world. What little pieces of their knowledge or their experience do you pick up and take with you?
Well, I'm coming not for recipes. I'm coming for their philosophies. Like here in Attica, I see Ben's how he works with his team, and how he uses some ingredients, and how he talks, and for me that's very important. So whenever I have the chance to travel and see different restaurants, for me it's the whole learning, and of course it's a promotion of what I do, and at the end of course I want people to go to Peru and experience not Central, experience what's Peru.
We've seen a huge growth in our understanding of and our appreciation for Central and South America. And if I look at us globally, I think for about the last 4 or 5 years, people keep telling me the next big thing in Australia is Peruvian cuisine. Is there a way to identify Peruvian cuisine like we would say Italian or Chinese or French?
I think in these days it's very difficult now to put a label like before, like this is Chinese, this is Italian, this is French. I mean, like now to say this is Peruvian is like it's very difficult because what is it, like is it Amazonian, is it Andean, is it Limian, is it Creole, is it Chinese Peruvian, which is Chifa, is it Nikkei, which is Japanese Peruvian. So just to put a label on what's Peruvian food is quite difficult, and I think just like the way these things are now, it's like there are many cuisines and different concepts, and most of them are hardly influenced by different cuisines.
Is this your first trip to Australia?
This is the second one. Yeah.
Both in Melbourne?
Yes.
What draws you here? What makes you want to come back?
Well, every time in Central, I have like probably two tables coming from Australia, and I get a long conversation with Australians, and mostly people from Melbourne.
And we're the classy ones.
But yeah, you know, Australia is a fascinating country. I see all the ingredients that you have, and it's like Peru, like ingredients that you have, but you don't know them, and you find difficult to show to your guests, or you find difficult to promote them, and I think we have a lot of similitudes, and being so far away, you know.
And have you found an ingredient here in Australia that you like to work with, and you'd love to have in Peru?
Well, the obvious one, kangaroo.
I don't know how to prove it.
But you have lots of llamas here, right now, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Alpaca, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. More than in Peru, you know?
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so I'm going to steal some kangaroos. I'll do the same.
Is there, there's a project you have that's quite close to your heart that is not in the kitchen. It's sort of kind of your research arm or your discovery space. Tell me about that project.
Yeah, that's called Mater Iniciativa, and we did that because we had the need of having a team to do what we were doing by ourselves. And at one point we found out that we didn't have much time, we didn't have sponsors, and it was difficult to do what we were doing, which was like just register ingredients that were not part of our gastronomy knowledge. So we start to talk about like working with different disciplines and understanding our territory, our geography, and in different aspects, you know. So nowadays we work with anthropologists, artists, and different disciplines, and this team is just, you know, like it's promoting our culture, of course, promoting our ingredients, and also, well, actually nowadays is kind of the soul of what's happening in Central, because if this without this knowledge, there's no Central to do.
Virgilio, it's been a pleasure to meet you. I know you've got to get back to the kitchen and brief some chefs on at a dinner tonight. The book is published by Fiden. It's a beautiful book. Every good bookstore will have your book, of course. And it's been a delight to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.